From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1894, a poor farmer from Spanish Fork, Utah, John Hiram Coyle, says he had a vision. Coyle, who was a Mormon bishop, says he was visited by an angel. In fact, the same angel who visited Mormon founder Joseph Smith, Angel Moroni. Coyle says the angel told him where he could find a gold mine in the hills not far from his house, a mine that also happened to be filled with the treasure of an ancient people. It may sound far-fetched today, but for Mormons of the time, these kinds of stories were common, and Bishop Coyle acted on his vision. In fact, a week later, he and others began digging what has come to be known as the Dream Mine, or the Relief Mine. This is more than just a piece of folklore. There are still believers in the mine. There are still stockholders in the mine. And all of this makes for a pretty good story, which we'll talk about when we get back from the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Mormons who lived in the Utah Territory in the 1890s were used to stories of the supernatural, stories of magic and treasure and angels and prophets. So it wasn't all that unusual when word got out that a poor farmer and a Mormon bishop from Spanish Fork, Utah, had been visited by an angel in 1894. John Coyle himself never wrote down the story, but one version or another has become a popular piece of folklore in Utah. Coyle says the angel took him to a mountain on the outskirts of Spanish Fork, told him that it contained vast amounts of gold, and that it also held in secret vaults the treasure of an ancient people. Well, the story of the Dream Mine, or the Relief Mine, persists. People today still have stock in the mine, even though no one has found even an ounce of gold. Joining us on the program is Kevin Cantera, who teaches history at Salt Lake Community College. He wrote an essay about the Dream Mine for the book Between Pulpit and Pew, which explores the relationship between Mormonism and the paranormal. And Kevin Cantera, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So I guess the way to start is, when did you first find this story? When did you first come to this story and decide, gosh, I need to find out more?
Well, it's funny because I have lived in Utah County on and off since the mid-80s, yeah, and knew nothing about the Dream Mine, even though it's fairly well known down in Utah County. Yeah. Moved to Payson from Salt Lake a few years ago, and from Payson, I can see the mill, which is part of the mine, from my front yard. And so I'd stand in my front yard and look east towards the mountain, and it's a very striking building. It's been compared to an Egyptian temple by some folklore.
Very strange looking.
Yeah, it's like white, bleached out boxes stacked on top of each other. It's also very interesting how it's sort of recessed into the mountain. So it follows the angle of the mountain and faces north. So anyways, I saw this great looking building there and I thought, well, now does someone live here? Is this a relic? What is this? Yeah. And started digging around and found such a great story. I just had to write about it.
It sounds kind of far-fetched, obviously. I mean, when you tell it, okay, an angel comes and literally takes this guy, and we'll tell the story as we go, but to this mountain, and it has this treasure, and it has all of this gold. But there's more to it here than just this kind of far-fetched story, because it's a reflection of something, it seems, Kevin, more complicated, how certain people believed or believe. Is that part of the fascination for you?
To me, I have to say that is the fascination, is the belief that the Dream Mine brings out in people. To me, and I know we're going to talk a little bit about the origins of the mine, but to me, it's a way for people to straddle the original LDS church, you know, the church that Joseph Smith founded in the 1830s, and then the modern church, which is frankly quite a bit different than that church. The Dream Mine to believers is a way for them to keep a foot in both worlds, if that makes sense. Mm. To have a place within the magical world of Mormonism's origins, yeah, but then also have something very tangible to keep them in the modern world.
So it's kind of, in some ways, a symbol. It's interesting you write about it as going beyond the material world. It's a promise in a world yet to come. That's a big thing.
That's a big thing. And that's, again, it's directly tied to the origins of Mormonism. You know, it's the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Yeah. It's, It's
this idea of final days.
Exactly. Its identity is inseparable from the last days, the end times, when the tumultuous times before Jesus returns to the earth. That's what the LDS Church is founded on, is to bring that to pass. Mm. And that's exactly what the Dream Mine is all about. The Dream Mine is a way for people to take an active role, be active, not just sit around waiting for the end times to come, but they have a role. They have a very sacred, important role to play when those times roll around in Dream Mine theology, if that's the proper word.
Yeah. How hard is it to tell the story or really break down the story? Because you say in your essay that a lot of the narratives come from true believers. I mean, so they have a sort of a sense of it already.
Yes. You mentioned in the opening, Bishop Coyle, John Coyle, the founder of the Dream Mine, the dreamer of the Dream Mine, he never wrote anything down. And he claims he was told specifically, don't write anything down. Very different from Joseph Smith in that way, by the
way.
But his believers or his followers, however you want to look at them, people who believed in the Dream Mine, believed in what John Coyle was dreaming, a few of them did write down the two most common written narratives are Norman Pierce's Dream Mine story and then Ogden Kraut, who wrote a book about, it's called John Coyle's Relief Mine.
Yeah.
They were both believers. They both fully bought into what John Coyle was selling, not to put too fine a point on it.
Yeah. So I guess the question then is, did that make it difficult to be objective about trying to tell it? They have or did it make it easier in some ways?
In some ways it did, because especially the approach I took was not to, okay, is the Dream Mine true? Is this mountain in Utah County full of gold? I'm not going to try and answer that question. I want to understand why people believe what they do and why does this still excite people and give them so much faith today. And so, from that angle, it was actually nice to have the narratives from a couple of true believers and see how they create this narrative to echo ideas that are common within Mormonism. Mm. In a lot of ways, the story of John Coyle echoes the story of Joseph Smith. I write in my paper that I believe this is done, whether consciously or otherwise, to draw in these believers, to put them in the Mormon milieu, so to speak, give them legends and myths that they can really understand and relate to, because they already, if you've bought into the Mormon story, you've bought into the fact that angels bring people visions of treasure, and that treasures are buried beneath the earth, and that these treasures are part of the fulfillment of times. And
that there are these ancient civilizations
right,
who were once here.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing that's interesting about the Dream Mine, is it's directly connected to the story in the Book of Mormon.
Directly.
Directly connected. And
Which we'll talk about.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
How many, when people hear that you're writing about it or that you have written about it, how many people in Utah County do you encounter, or anywhere around this state for that matter, who say, oh, yeah, I knew someone who did this or who had stock or who was a believer? I mean, it must happen all the time.
It happens all the time. I'm amazed. And it's not just Utah County, although it's a very Utah County phenomenon. I get people from northern Utah, southern Utah, people who, if you've had family in, if you're descended from people who lived in Utah around the turn of the century to, say, 1940, it's surprising how many people either own stock or their stock in the family, or
worked there.
If at least they know about the story.
Yeah.
And so it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about John Coyle, John Hiram Coyle.
Mm-hmm.
You write a little bit about it. He had this reputation for being, even when he was young, being kind of this pious little boy. Goes with his family down into the southern Utah colonies, sent there by Brigham Young, the early Mormon leader. People, I'm sure, know that part of the story. It's interesting, the story that you tell about him. He didn't get his, what Mormons call this testimony of the Book of Mormon, or their testimony of Mormonism, which is this sense of inspiration that comes from God confirming this belief. He didn't get that right off the bat. He had to kind of work for it. And there's a kind of a cool story about this cow.
Yeah.
Tell that.
The red heifer story.
The red heifer, yeah.
Which is interesting because there's connotation to the red heifer in the Old Testament. But we won't dig into that here. Yeah, John Coyle, he was a young man. He was working in the farm or in the field one day, and he wanted that testimony that you're talking about. The Mormons often refer to it as a burning in the bosom, and he wanted to feel that, but he didn't.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he had a dream. He was missing a cow. A red heifer had gone missing from the farm, and he had a dream that showed him where this cow would be. And in his dream, this personage comes to him and says, you know, you're going to find your cow, missing cow, in this particular area. And when you do, that will confirm.
That's your sign.
Yeah, that's your sign. Exactly. This will confirm to you that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the true church. And this is where you'll get your testimony. Mm. And sure enough, he got up the next morning, went down, found the cow with the— it's described as having a crooked horn. Something had happened to it, so it was this— it had a bad horn. And sure enough, he found it, and that was the confirmation he was looking for. And from then on, he was a devout Mormon and continued to have dreams, yeah. Obviously. Continued to have dreams to, you know, expand his testimony.
Had this reputation as having these kinds of prophecies. Mm-hmm. He would make these pronouncements of things that he would see, and people said he got it right a lot of the time.
Yeah. According to people who knew him, he predicted, all kinds of things. The Great Depression or the stock market crash, the day of Japanese surrender in World War II, various things like that. And there's plenty, you know, there's other people who know a lot more about his prophecies and how they turned out. But
yeah, he had that reputation.
He definitely had that reputation from early on. And Ogden Kraut, who is one of these people who followed him and wrote the book, said he was the only prophet he'd ever met, only true prophet he'd ever met. So
now it's important, I guess we should say, that John Coyle wanting to go and get this sense of inspiration, that is a very typical sort of Mormon motif. It's what Joseph Smith did, right? Going out into what they call the sacred grove,
mm-hmm.
this place where they receive this inspiration. So I guess that's important to understand that these— some of these stories, certainly this one, follows that kind of pattern. It's important to say that this fit into a kind of pattern.
Yeah, there's a narrative here that, like I said earlier, echoes the stories that Mormons would be familiar with, including this one that, in Joseph Smith's case, it was the revelation none of the churches are true.
Yeah.
I mean, he had gone out to pray for, you know, revelation to tell him which church to join. The answer came back, none of them.
Right.
But again, it is similar, where you're beseeching God essentially for some sort of verification of your beliefs and getting that.
Yeah.
And then there's obviously other places along the John Coyle story that also echo the Joseph Smith narrative.
This used to be something of a common belief among mainstream Mormons at an earlier time. I mean, that's— you were saying before, this kind of magical worldview may not be reflective of the way Mormons believe today, not entirely.
Right.
Which is, but this was pretty common in that day. They weren't so far removed from those ideas.
Right. And that's what I mean when I say the Dream Mind's kind of this bridge between these two worlds. Because, yeah, it was, you know, John Coyle was not that far out there for the people he lived among in Utah County around, you know, 1880s, 1890s. You know, this was just a generation or so removed from the founding of the church. The church was founded to usher in the last days in some form or another. So these were people who, you know, were steeped in this idea. And so John Coyle, yeah, he fit in quite well from that perspective.
I guess it reveals how much distance Mormonism has made between that more kind of quirky or magical past and today. And I guess some of that is the church officials trying to create some distance between that sense.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. And I think that's another aspect of this story that reveals a lot about not just more believers today, but the evolution of Mormonism from this time period to today. in the different reactions the church has had to John Quayle and Dream Mind. For a time there, the church officials were very adamant against the Dream Mind and John Quayle.
Yeah. We'll talk about that reaction too, because it's interesting. But let's get to the story itself. Okay, this is 1894. We should say John Quayle is just back from a Mormon mission. So I guess it's fair to say he's filled.
Full of the Spirit.
Full of the Spirit. Okay, yeah. So what happens? Tell us the story. What happens?
Quayle was 30 years old, if I'm remembering correctly my dates. And he went to bed. He lived in the river bottom area of Spanish Fork, which is, you know, southern Utah County near the eastern mountains. And he goes to bed one night. And during the night, the angel Moroni, the same angel that showed Joseph Smith where the golden plates lay hidden, which became the Book of Mormon, yeah, comes into his bedroom and takes him on a journey, an out-of-body experience, if you will, and leads him straight into a mountain, just less than 2 miles from his house, due east of his house just about, from the farm to the mountain. And he leads him through about 2,000, 3,000 feet of solid rock, this mountain. And if you see it, it's this cone-shaped mountain in Utah County. And he descended into it, and he passed a vein of gold. I believe he called it a white quartz, which was full of gold. Mm-hmm. And he said the gold was there. You could see it, and it was like a fish waiting to be fried. That's how accessible it was.
Yeah.
And so there's all this gold in mineral form, ready to be mined. But then underneath that were these chambers, wide open chambers full of gold that had already been minted.
Coins, yes.
Coins and other treasures, mm-hmm, breastplates and crowns and bracelets. What do you make with gold? All these, you know, ancient artifacts made of gold that had been mined there by the Nephites. And the Nephites are a group. The Book of Mormon is the story of the Nephites, essentially, and it's the tale of a group of exiled Jews who left Jerusalem around 600 BC, sailed to the New World, and became the progenitors of the Native Americans. And essentially, the Book of Mormon is the tale of their activities here in the New World.
Yeah.
They, according to Quayle, Native American people, Nephites, before long ago, around 600 BC, one would assume, were in this area of Utah County mining gold out of this mountain, minting it into coins and other valuables, and then burying it there in anticipation of the end times, in which this gold would become the relief for the saints, to fund the saints in Mormon.
That's why they call it the relief mine.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Because during the time of trials at the end times, Mormons will need some money to get back to Missouri, which is where the final scene of, Jesus will return to Missouri and the temple will be built there. So Quayle doesn't get all this that one night where Moroni leads him in. This first night he's led into the mountain. He's shown this wonderful vision. He sees all the gold in the mountain. And then over time he gets more revelations telling him more about what this gold is intended for, essentially. Mm. And yeah, he starts digging about a week or so later with some good friends. There's a story about that as well. The sun shines directly on the spot where they're supposed to start digging. So there's another sign there, and they start digging in 1894. Project starts attracting attention. Like we said, you know, Quayle has a reputation as a dreamer and a prophet. And so people start hearing about Quayle's got a mind. He knows something's going on. You know, people are ready.
And word
for this.
Spreads.
Word spreads real fast. Exactly.
You know what else is interesting is if someone were to start digging in a mountain today, he would be seen as a kook. But they didn't see Quayle as a kook.
No, Quayle was well loved. And you know, I'm sure there were skeptics.
Sure.
But it seems Quayle seems to me, even skeptics like this guy, you know, even skeptics were drawn to him. He had one of those personalities, and you know, when someone believes something really firmly, some of that, you know, rubs off on other people.
Yeah. Well, before we go to break, let's take a call. Joel is with us, happens to be in Spanish Fork. Joel, welcome.
Oh,
hi.
Good. Yeah, I grew up in Bishop Quayle's ward, and I was a young scout back in the late 60s and 70s. And my scoutmaster was really into it. He would take us up to the mountain, And on the back side of the mountain, there's what used to be a cave, and it has some Indian glyphs that, to me, I'm an anthropologist now, and it looks like a typical glyph, but they interpreted that as mules going to, or some sort of animal going down into this cave full and coming out empty, leaving the treasure. And the story that we had was that the saints didn't like what was going on. The members of the ward that were treasure hunting went and dynamited that cave. And that's when Coyle had the dream to go onto the front side of the mountain and dig in from the front side of the mountain. And also that same scoutmaster would show us where the old Nephite roads were, which were actually sediments left by Lake Bonneville, and also showed us the hole in the rock where the sun shone through on the equinox to show them where to start digging. And I just thought it was kind of fascinating growing up with the whole Coyle story right in my backyard.
Wow. Have you heard that story of the? I mean,
yeah,
it's a pretty extensive story.
Yeah, no, there's I haven't seen the glyphs for myself, but supposedly I've heard from many people that there are glyphs allegedly depicting I don't know if it's pack animals, donkeys, what it is, and yeah, if you see there is an old shoreline from Lake Bonneville, which, you know, for those who don't know, Lake Bonneville filled the Salt Lake Valley down to Utah County and far north, a prehistoric lake, and it left shoreline all over the Wasatch Mountains. And one of those shorelines is considered they call it the Old Nephite Highway.
Yeah.
Because what they do is mine the gold from the mountain, take it along the highway to what is essentially Pea Mountain now in Payson, about 5 miles to the west, where it was smelted and turned into coins or whatever else, and then back along the Nephite Highway to the mine for storage.
Mm. So. Joel, you guys still have any stock in that mine?
My dad has. I've asked for the stock just out of curiosity. My grandfather got the stock. He cut the road with his cat up to the mill, and Coyle, who didn't have any money, paid him in stock. My grandfather told my family that we could never sell the stock, but I think that was based more on his belief that Coyle was kind of a charlatan and he didn't want to fool anybody else with the stock. The ward, the stories that I got as a young man was that the members of the church were rather divided. There were the ones that really believed in Coyle, and they're the ones that thought that they were wasting their time when they should be working the fields and plowing the fields and working, and it was quite divisive in that early part. Hence, they dynamited this cave with the glyphs. The glyphs are very typically Fremont Ute glyphs. I mean, there's nothing unusual about the glyphs, but the way they were interpreted by the early saints, it was a hunting scene where you saw deer coming down and going up the canyon. This is called Water Canyon, but it got interpreted as pack animals for some reason.
Because for Woofit, the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joel, thanks. Glad you called.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks.
All right. One more before we take a break. Lisa is with us in Sandy. Lisa, hi.
Doug, love your show
always. Thanks.
Just barely tuned in for the last couple of minutes and heard a little bit about the dream mine. And my family, it sounds like the last caller too, has inherited some stock down the road. And my sister, who lives in Spanish Fork, wanted it more than anybody because she's actually, you know, down there and has heard about it. But
yeah.
I'm wondering, what's the scoop? I mean, is it worth anything other than, you know, like as a historical token of that time? Or is there still any kind of company that exists? Or, you know, what's the deal?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, those are excellent questions. And I can tell you there is ongoing. It's called the Relief Mine Company. It's in operation. I have their profit and loss sheets from the last few years. They hold stockholder meetings every May. And I'm not sure what your level of belief is, whether you want to keep the stock or sell it, but there's people willing to pay $30 to $35 per share for stock.
You can still trade stock in the
game. Yeah, it's privately traded. It's a private company, but stock is bought and sold all the time.
Wow. Lisa, glad you called. We're talking about the Dream Mine, and we'll talk more when we get back from a break. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio.
Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a story of Utah folklore. If you've lived here for a while, you may have come across the tale of John Coyle's dream mine or relief mine. Kevin Cantera is with us, teaches history at Salt Lake Community College. He wrote an essay about the dream mine for the book Between Pulpit and Pew, which explores the relationship between Mormonism and the paranormal. And he's with us here in the studio. And Kevin Kraut is also with us. He is the son of the late Ogden Kraut, a prominent independent fundamentalist who wrote some 65 books on religion. Kevin Kraut owns Pioneer Publishing, which has reprinted a number of his father's books, including two on the relief mine. And Kevin Kraut, welcome to you.
Well, thank you for inviting me here today.
Thanks very much for being with us. Well, let me ask you, I suppose you must have grown up hearing all kinds of stories about the dream mine, the relief mine.
All kinds of stories from total non-belief in my family to 100% belief in my family.
Really? So it was mixed in your family?
Oh, very mixed.
Because your father was a believer.
Very much. He worked with Bishop Coyle, so he was in the mine with Bishop Coyle. And he had many experiences where Bishop Coyle prophesied things, and so he knew exactly how accurate, even to the day. And that was one thing my dad did say about Bishop Coyle that was different than anybody else. He said, so there's so many people that could say, well, you know, during this time, this is going to happen. But Bishop Coyle would actually say the exact day, on this day, this is going to happen.
Hmm.
And that was the incredible thing that my dad witnessed, and that's why Dad had such a liking for him. He said it was just nobody had anything like that man.
I think your dad, I've read about your father, and he could spot a BS artist from a mile away, and he didn't think Bishop Coyle was a BS artist. Is
no,
that fair to
all.
Say?
No, not at all. Yeah. Well, he had so many different people come into his office that was the one mighty and strong or this or that, and you know, and many of them would prophesy things, and, you know, he said, having been around Bishop Coyle, nobody matched him.
Mm.
Nobody came close.
So, what did he do in the mine? You said he worked in the mine. So, because there's an important question here. Were they looking for the gold, or were they supposed to wait? You know that okay, the gold is here, but it's not going to come in, as they say in mine terminology. This is not going to be revealed until the end of days. So were you supposed to just sort of sit there and wait, or were you supposed to start digging? I mean, what was the idea?
Well, there was kind of a mixed idea, because they knew that the whole mine wasn't going to come out, you know, until the last days or when there was an actual financial collapse of the nation. When our dollar fell to nothing, Bishop Coyle saw the dollars flying in the wind. Nobody even bothered to pick them up because they weren't worth anything.
Hmm.
And so, but they knew they had to prepare for it. They had to get ready for it. And then, you know, just like the coming of Christ, nobody knows the exact day or when or how. And so there's all that presumption that it could be tomorrow, but it may be many years from now. And so there was that kind of a stacking up of what was happening. But as they got closer and closer to the actual, you know, five veins, the main ore bodies, and where they were actually down in the winds and digging near where they figured the very last part was, that anticipation got really hot.
Hmm.
People were really thinking things were going to really happen.
So they were mining.
That's... They were definitely mining. They were definitely digging. Some of them took some of the ore out, had it processed, tested, found that it had like 33 ounces per ton in one area. You know, it had values. You know, there were things there.
Well, Kevin Cantera, what's the other side to that? I mean, there's a great story you tell in your piece about Mormon apostle by the name of James Talmadge, who not only was this beloved Mormon apostle, he happened to be a beloved scientist. He was a geologist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was, of course, part of the official church, was skeptical about all of this. He said the ore was worthless.
Right. Right. And here's a place of contention between believers in the Dream Mine and the official church, the hierarchical church here in Salt Lake City. It is... What is the worth? What does a true assayer's test say about the soil here on the site? James Talmadge, who was a trained geologist, was essentially sent down by the church to see, okay, is Coyle just having everyone on, or what's going on down there? And he did a test of the soil and said it's worthless. But then, you know, folks here like Kevin Kraut and others, folks who believe in it say just the opposite, that no assay tests have shown that there is gold here. It's in a form that's difficult to extract. As far as I can tell from a purely business standpoint, you know, look at the books kind of thing, there hasn't been any money made from any kind of ore, gold or otherwise, at the mine. But to echo what Kevin was saying, there have been periods where people were sure it was time for the mine to come in. And a real interesting time was during the Great Depression, which if you know, the Great Depression hit Utah extremely hard. I think unemployment here in Salt Lake was close to 35%, which was, you know, unthinkable. So it was a tough time on people, farmers, beet farmers in Utah County and otherwise. Yet somehow they scraped together, these believers in the Dream Mine scraped together some $60,000 or more to build a mine that Coyle had seen. And Coyle essentially had this mine built from his head. Architects would come in and try and sketch things out, and he said, "Oh no, we've already built that because it came straight out of my head." So, and that's what you see, by the way, when you go down to Utah County and are looking for the mine, and you see the big white building on the mountainside. That's what you're seeing. You're seeing the mill that was built during the 30s, during the Great Depression.
Kevin Kraut, you say that it was never supposed to be about the gold. The gold, the idea wasn't to make money. It was about something. There was a bigger purpose.
Yeah, the bigger purpose, you know, in the early days, I was reading a Mormon diary of an old diary the other day, and it even said that America would get very strong. Its people would get powerful. They would lose the true value of money. They'd get greedy, and then there would be a government kind of come in and take over, and then they would start to usurp the people, and the people would, you know, have a hard time. And then the economics would crash. So this was a Mormon thought from the very beginning of some people. And then the economics would crash, and that's when all this stuff would be coming together for united order, where the people would have to band together and help each other. And that's what the relief mine was for, from the premise was we're going to save this nation from this terrible economic collapse. We're going to get the people to come together. Bishop said if there was 10 families that could unify themselves and come into harmony, no greater blessings could ever be had, kind of like the City of Enoch type thought. And so it was all those things that was brought in to somehow try and save the church, save the people, save the nation, all of that all together. And that's why it was so believable by people, especially with an individual who could tell you the day when something was going to happen, the stock market's going to crash on this day, which it did. Mm. And so,
well, plus he was your Mormon bishop, right? Yeah. I mean, he at least for a time.
He was removed though from
that's right.
His
fairly quickly
position.
Thereafter.
Yeah,
I guess.
Actually,
yeah,
he was.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, you need to understand some of the complexities of why that began to happen. What happened was Bishop Coyle had this unique prophetic gift. The church presidents from 1890, kind of in that time frame, they began to lose those gifts. And there was a little opposition that happened because Joseph F. Smith told the people in Mexico, if you give up plural marriage and you abide by us and you do these things, we'll build the next temple there for you. And so the people did this, and then the word got back to Bishop Coyle, and he said, well, that's not what I saw. I saw the people running out with backpacks on their backs, and there wasn't any Mormons in there. Well, what happened was Pancho Villa came through, and that's exactly what happened. They all had to flee. Mm. So now you got the LDS prophet saying one thing and Bishop Coyle saying another, and that got a little bit tense.
Well, this is another Kevin Cantera, big important part of the story is this reflects the kind of ideological split. And polygamy was part of this as well. I mean, you had the sort of fundamentalist and your father, Ogden, was a fundamentalist.
Definitely,
it's
yes.
Fair to say. I suppose you are too?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
So there was this sense that this fundamentalist belief that Mormon leaders began to sort of stray from the truth. That's an important part of understanding this story as well.
It is, yeah. And as Kevin Kraut was just talking about, you know, there's this tension that develops between the official prophet of the church and unofficial John Coyle prophet. And it's really interesting. It reveals a lot about Mormonism in terms of where does official doctrine come from in Mormonism? Because obviously it's a top-down religion. You know, you have the Book of Mormon, you have the brethren who run the church. At the same time, you know, Mormon theology embraces the idea of personal revelation.
Yeah.
And so what's the dynamic there? And that's what was really interesting to me is this dynamic between official revelation and personal revelation. And when does a personal revelation start to contradict the official revelation? And yeah, the Coyle story is a great window into this dynamic that still exists in a lot of ways in Mormonism. But was very important, like you say, during this period when the church was reshaping its image, was trying to move away from this, original Mormonism. You can read certain documents to suggest that they thought an overthrow of the United States was imminent to usher in the Second Coming. They embraced certain doctrines like plural marriage. Okay, and then in the 1890s, they're starting to try and change that image, and it doesn't happen overnight. A lot has to do with, stathood and seating of Reed Smoot, who was a Mormon senator. And so they're
a Mormon apostle.
Yes. And trying to reshape this. And so the church's reaction to Coyle does shed a lot of light on that. In fact, they shut down the Dream Mine for a time for about 4 years early on. The story is they reopened it because Coyle owed money to the local ZCMI in Utah County and couldn't pay back his bills unless they started working again. So they allowed him to reopen.
Well, it is interesting also that Coyle is relieved of his duties as a Mormon bishop, but they replace him with a guy who was a believer.
I always thought that was interesting as well. Yeah.
And he has a relationship with a Mormon leader in the hierarchy, a fellow by the name of J. Golden Kimball.
Right.
Who he himself seems to be a believer. He certainly held stock in it, which is interesting too.
Yeah. There were a few apostles, general authorities, I guess more accurate, that did own stock and apparently believed. So again, you have this sort of tension within the hierarchy versus the people, and it's just so revealing to see that belief is negotiated. Belief doesn't you have to work your way around some of these things, and if you truly believe in something, I think you're able to negotiate a space that allows you to consider the prophet here in Salt Lake City as the leader of the church, but also accept John Coyle's revelation as something that's very important to the fulfillment of what that church is trying to do.
Hmm. Kevin Kraut, did you have something else?
Real quick, one of the things about this is the early brethren talked about gold in the mountains and gold all through the area.
You say brethren, we should explain to those uninitiated, you're talking about Mormon church leaders.
Yes, the church leaders at that time. Here's one quote out of the Journal of Discourses, and it says, Brother Lorenzo Snow says that the Lord will bless my brethren and sisters. He says that all the mules in the territory cannot haul away the gold that is concealed in these mountains.
So it was a big part of the belief.
And Brigham Young once stood down by Santaquin and pointed up to the mountains there where Bishop Coyle's mine is and said, "There, this holds most of the gold in the world right here." And so the old leaders of the church did believe in those concepts. It's just that they changed as time went by, along with other things.
Let's take another call before we go to a break. Weston is in Elk Ridge, Utah. Weston, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
No, thank you.
Sure.
I really found the topic interesting. Growing up in southern Utah County, I kind of took a little bit of pride in knowing that my family owned stock in the mine, not necessarily for what it would provide us, but basically it kind of showed that we were the native, the old family of southern Utah County, and so it's very interesting. Wanted to ask the guests about the legend of Kerry Chenobe and how it relates to the Dream Mine, and I can take the answers off the air.
Okay, Kevin Kraut, legend of Kerry Chenobe?
Yeah, some say snob, but anyway. Kerry Boren wrote a book on that, and I actually published one of Kerry's book, The Widow's Son. It's a very intricate book on early Mormonism beliefs and the esoteric history of Joseph Smith. But the Kerchnob also, there are several mines. In fact, we were talking on the way up here that there were many mines that Bishop Coyle said would come out before the time that the Relief Mine would. In fact, the Relief Mine would be one of the last mines that would come out. There would be other mines that would definitely come out. There's a chief, a Ute Indian chief, that actually showed a gentleman where that that was, that mine was. It's believed it's in the Uintas. It could possibly be in another location. And that was where the gold came from for the gold that's on the Moroni and the temple. When Brigham Young needed gold, they would go up there. The Indians would show them where this is. The treasures would go. The story is that it's full of vast gold. There's actually a KUED special that was done. I can't remember the name of it, but it talks about mining in Utah. And there was a quote by Lincoln that calls it the treasure house of the nation. And so apparently Lincoln also knew that, like the movie National Treasure, that this area here in Utah was where that national treasure was. And, of course, the Kerishnab has that. And they also have many chiefs that are buried there, many records that are buried there. One of the things we were talking about on the way up was the Indians like to bury treasure with their sacred stuff because the white men will come and grab the gold and run off with it and leave the sacred stuff there.
Hmm. Kevin Kintyre, you could write not just an essay, a book, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of material there. And just to add real quickly, part of the draw for the Dream Mine is it's not just gold. It's other important pieces of Mormon lore, including artifacts from the Book of Mormon and the Sword of Laban. And then probably most importantly, a lot of believers think that the original gold plates are stored in the Dream Mine. And if you know much about Mormon theology, you know that what Joseph Smith translated off those plates is just scratches the surface. So part of the mine coming in is also the fulfillment of the full gospel, if you will. You know, you'll get all those things from the golden plates that have yet to be seen.
And a confirmation of their faith, that they weren't just believing in a story, right?
Sure, exactly. That's what's so amazing. It's tangible. You know, I mean, how audacious to try and make something tangible from your faith. That was Joseph Smith's great audacity. Yeah. It was to come up with a book that says, believe in me or not. That's, you know, that takes something. That takes some courage. And so to have something tangible there that actually shows, yes, I'm right, I think is a big draw.
All right, we need to take another break. Kevin Kintyre is with us, teaches history at Salt Lake Community College. He wrote an essay about the Dream Mine for the book Between Pulpit and Pew, which explores the relationship between Mormonism and the paranormal. Kevin Kraut with us as well. He owns Pioneer Publishing, has reprinted his Father Ogden Kraut's books, Relief Mine and Relief Mine 2. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER
and Sirius XM Public Radio.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Dream Mine. Journalist and historian Kevin Kintyre is with us, along with Kevin Kraut, who owns Pioneer Publishing. He's reprinted his father's books. Ogden Kraut is his father. His books, two books about the Relief Mine, Relief Mine and Relief Mine 2. Let's go back to the phones. Nolan is with us in Salt Lake. Nolan, sorry for the wait.
No problem. My family grew up in Payson, and although I never lived there, I grew up on stories about the Dream Mine. A couple of years ago, I was in Utah County visiting a client and mentioned the fact that I had some curiosity about the mine. And this woman, who is an older woman, said, "That's interesting because I was the secretary that took notes during the excommunication trial of Bishop Coyle." Of course, I was very interested to hear about that. And so they admonished him to, you know, change his ways and so forth. And he wasn't very interested in doing that. Then he turned, according to this woman, to the state prison and told him he could go to hell.
Hmm. Wow. Well, tell that story, Kintyre, because it's a good one. I mean, he, as I understand the story, at first he did sign a statement repudiating his beliefs. At least it didn't last long. But
this is another one of those where you're going to bump into a couple different stories depending on who's telling it, right? And so if you take the official church position, Coyle recanted everything. And I believe this is 1948. He's very old at this point. Right. He's about 82, 83. And he recants everything. They bring him up. They haul him up to Salt Lake and take him behind the woodshed, essentially. And he recants. He says, "No, I'm not a prophet. No, there's no gold in the mine," et cetera, et cetera. later recants that. Yeah. Later among his own people down in Utah County, he says, no, I was lying to them, or no, I never said that, or you know, essentially saying he still believed. And when that came out, he was eventually excommunicated.
Yeah, it was sort of the final straw.
Right. But there's plenty of people, and maybe Kevin Kraut can help us out here, who don't believe that story, don't believe he was ever excommunicated, and in fact claim that Coyle had received what some call a second anointing, which is a temple ceremony that essentially guarantees you entrance into the highest level of heaven, and so therefore could never have been excommunicated because you don't excommunicate people who have had their second anointing. So this is a area of debate.
Yeah.
Essentially.
So what do you know, Kevin Kraut?
Well, the folklore behind this was that the two of the three Nephites came to Bishop Coyle one night, told him all these different things. He says, and then they relayed a whole bunch more for like an hour and a half and said, don't tell this to anybody except for the general authorities. You can audience them. And so the story was that when the general authorities came to him, he said, if I sign this, will you allow me to tell you the story? And so he signed the document, and then they recanted, and they didn't allow him to tell the story. And so he was very upset. There was a lot of hard feelings there because he really wanted to tell them what these two Nephites had to say about what was going on.
Oh, yeah, the two Nephites. That's another interesting element. And we should explain, just I don't want to get into it too much, but even modern Mormons believe that there are three so-called Nephites who are wandering
right.
the world, still alive from those days.
Nephites from the Americas were here when Jesus visited the Americas during the 3 days between crucifixion and resurrection, if I'm getting this right, I hope, and visited the Americas, visited the Nephites, ordained three of those Nephites to live until the last days. And yeah, those three Nephites, there's so much great Mormon folklore about these three Nephites, and there's plenty of people around who say, you know, oh yeah, I was... my car broke down by the side of the road. One of the Nephites came up and, you know, got the spark plugs working or whatever.
There's a lot of that. Yeah.
And Coyle, they play a huge role in Coyle's story.
Absolutely.
In fact, that's where Coyle apparently got the story about what's going to happen with the gold, like what the gold is set aside for. He learned
got it
that
from those guys.
From the two of the three.
The two of the three, yeah.
The third was out helping people.
Change their spark plugs.
My dad even wrote a book called The Three Nephites, which tells a lot of those folklore stories, a lot of things that happened. But one of the interesting things is about in the 1880s, they took a poll in the church and asked everybody if they had had an experience with one of the three Nephites or whatever. And just about every family had an experience that they could claim was one of the three Nephite stories, where they walked outside, they saw the two footsteps in the snow, and then the guy disappeared. You know.
So this is another. It seems like this is another example, Kevin Cantara, of the difference between the sort of quirkier beliefs in those days and nowadays. You may not hear that many stories. I can't say I do hear that many stories of three Nephites in modern day among modern day Mormons.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's interesting.
But I mean, I know it's there. I know there's still people who would tell these stories. But yeah, I mean, you know, 50 years ago, no one would bat an eyelash.
Exactly.
You told them that, you know, one of the three Nephites came and helped me through a rough patch.
Yeah,
obviously you don't mean to belittle, because sometimes these are people who are having very serious life crises, and, you know, one of the three Nephites helps them through that. But yeah, 50 years ago, no one would have batted an eyelash at that.
Let's take one more call. Garth is in Lehigh. Garth, welcome.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually a descendant of John Coyle.
Wow.
And I wanted to just comment on how, you know, the story of Joseph Smith made the story of John Coyle more believable. And I think for the posterity of John Coyle, we use the story, his story, as an example of how personal or revelation for other individuals comes. So we use his story to say a bad example. We joke about, you know, well, did it happen this way? Or, you know, what information are you getting now? Is it a way that Joseph Smith would have gotten it? Or is it coming through the church leaders? Or is it coming through you for many other people? But we've kind of turned the tables on the story from it being, just his own story to using his story as an example of following the principles that are taught of revelation, you know, in the Mormon church these days.
Yeah, well, Kevin Cantera, you're right that these stories echo important narratives in their Mormon faith. We were talking about that earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what the caller really gets at as well is this dynamic between personal revelation, official revelation. How do you determine whether your personal revelation is actually coming from God and is sanctified, so to speak, or you're a lunatic?
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally, both of you, because we've got only about a minute left. What happens now in that mine? Do people dig there anymore, Kevin Crowley?
No, it's pretty well. Bishop Coyle said there'd be like a dark space, you know, a stopping point, and then there'd be a little blue patch up near the point of the mountain, and then that would start it all up again, and that would be, you know, right around the time of the financial collapse.
So are people thinking that, you know, I mean, talk about the end of times. Talk about the dollar being worthless. I guess times like this when there's a financial meltdown, people probably think a lot about the dream mine.
About 4 years ago, I was talking to people about stock and trying to sell it, and it was about $15. Now people are starting to believe. They're starting to see that there could be some reason for this because it does talk about financial backing with gold, not just worthless money.
Well, yeah, and like I mentioned, the Great Depression was a time of intense activity up on the Dream Mine. So you can expect when the stock market crashed in 2008, yeah, Dream Mine stock went up and people got interested. And actually, you know, the company is going and they work up there every Saturday during the summer to fix things up. So they're getting ready. Yeah. They're getting ready.
Yeah. Kevin Cantera wrote an essay called The Currency of Faith, Taking Stock in Utah County's Dream Mine. Thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Kevin Kraut, thanks very much. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.